Hello. Welcome to Blacter. Join me as I examine the best of black artists in my quest to becoming one myself. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the season one finale of Blacter. I'm your host, Gabe Moses. If you haven't listened to part one, feel free to check out the amazing interview I had with Miss Rosalind Coleman Williams. Next, I'll be talking to actor and playwright Keith Hamilton Cobb. Known for his roles on All My Children and The Young and the Restless, Keith is also the lead in his original play, American Moor. I couldn't have chosen a better way to end a successful first season. Enjoy! Hello, Keith. Welcome to the show. It is a pleasure to have you on and to talk with you today.
I'm happy to be here, man. Thank you.
Absolutely. So do you want to start off with telling the people, you know, where you're from, where you grew up, and where you went to school?
I trained at NYU. That was where I got my actor training. Undergrad, Tisch School of the Arts undergrad. I grew up about 25 miles north of there on the Hudson River, a town called Tarrytown. And that's about it.
Simple as that. So did you know early on that you wanted to go to school for, you know, theater and acting?
I didn't. I remember doing some theater in summer school as I was a kid. You know, when I was a kid, summer school was a place to, like summer camp, a place to have your kids go and be involved in something and maybe learn something over the summer. And my parents sent me there, and I remember I was doing some theater then, but it was just because it seemed fun. It never occurred to me that it would be a thing for me to pursue. And then when I got into high school, I had a stronger sense that I could appreciate it, that I liked it, but I wasn't this sort of young man that was terribly social. I mean, I had my circle of friends, but I wasn't going to join a extracurricular club. I wasn't going to do the drama club or something like that. I just was not involved in that way. That never would have worked for me. Though I did see a high school production of Arthur Miller's The Crucible, which sort of shook me into awakening, an awakening of what theater was and could be. I mean, it still remains one of my favorite, if not my most favorite, play in the Western canon. And watching the high school actors be good enough to remain compelling and to convey to me this story was really sort of heart-changing and mind-changing. And I was made very aware that theater was a thing and what it could do. And, you know, I hadn't made a decision to make that my life, but I knew that it could be part of it. And then when I was in college, community college, you know, after high school, I did a couple of years of community college, kicking around, just wasting time, trying to find, you know, take a class here, a class there. I mean, my major was generally English, but I mean, I was sort of doing whatever I wanted to do just because I didn't want to commit to a future. And I was studying a lot of Shakespeare then and having problems with it, mostly because of the way it was taught prior. You know, the way that it is handed to us in high school is problematic in general. And I don't want to get deep into detail on that unless you want to, but you know, Western education, you know, it's just handing people Shakespeare's literature is difficult. And I was having those problems right on into college until I started seeing it performed. And luckily I saw some high quality productions, of which, you know, it's very hit and miss, American Shakespeare, very hard to find well done American Shakespeare, where what the actors are saying is all perfectly crystal clear, you know. And I was able to see some and realize that it wasn't a form that was supposed to be read, it was supposed to be performed. and wanted to do that, wanted to do more of that, particularly because of the way that Shakespeare's characters could speak vociferously about things that they felt without recrimination. You know, if you were able to embody the character, then you had this vent for all these emotions that you were feeling on this language. And that is really what started me wanting to pursue theater or acting in general as a career.
Do you remember your very first production?
Well, I guess the very first production was the one way back in summer school when I couldn't have been 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And that was a production of Thornton Wilder's Our Town.
Ah.
I played Howie Newsom, the milkman. Mm. And yeah, I don't remember much about it except that I'm sure I wasn't very good. But that was the first, I think, real. There might have been. I was raised in the Unitarian Universalist Church, and there might have been, prior to that time, a Christmas pageant that I was a part of. That, you know, it was more or less a theatrical production, but I'm not really sure which came first.
Yeah. Well, do you remember into college? What was kind of your moment of performing on stage where you were like, hey, I can kind of do this thing?
Well, there was a production of Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun in community college. And I felt nominally close to the role. I was playing the lead, the male lead, and I felt I know enough about this guy to convey what he's feeling and navigating. And for a college production, it was considered good work. And I got some accolades for it. And I thought, okay, well, there's validation. I must have done that right. That was probably the first time. I remember that one of my professors, the person who directed it, said, this is something that you might think about pursuing as a career because, you know, you seem to have some chops and a presence and, you know, some of the things that you're going to need in such a career. And if it's something that you really enjoy, maybe it's a direction that you want to go.
What was your first professional gig?
Wow, you're really making me think back.
We're going all the way back.
Remember all this stuff. Yeah. My first professional job, equity union job, was a production of Hamlet at... No, that is not correct. My first paying job was at the Jean Cocteau Repertory Theater, which was a theater on the corner of Bond and Bowery on the east side of New York. And they had a repertory company that had been there for many, many, many years doing classical texts. And it was a production of, it was an anniversary year for their namesake, for Jean Cocteau. And they were doing a production of his show called The Infernal Machine, which was a retelling of the Oedipus story. And I was playing Anubis, the Egyptian god of the dead. And I had a big headdress, you know, a half. If you know the character Anubis, if you've seen it in any of Egyptian iconography, he's the half man with the jackal's head.
Yeah.
And I had the big headpiece and a sort of a skirt and some sandals, and that was about it. And they had asked me to stay with the company for at least a season, and I said, well, I can do this production, but I really need to go start my career. If I sit here on the Lower East Side of Manhattan doing these shows, I won't really, you know, be out there doing what I need to do. So I made the choice to do just the one show and move on.
And then you did Hamlet.
and then came Hamlet. I was playing Laertes in a production that was, I believe the producers were the people from Shakespeare and Company, who operate out of Lenox, Massachusetts, and that was a company founded by a British woman named Tina Packer, and they were working out of the North Shore Music Theater on the North Shore of Massachusetts. And it wasn't very good, and I didn't have a lot of fun. And it was one of the early experiences with figuring out where I fit in terms of collaboration, making theater, how people were seeing me, how people were making use of me, how to navigate my personal intuition of correct and incorrect in terms of acting choices, et cetera, et cetera. It was an early example of that. Mm-hmm. And there were many more to come.
Yeah. Well, okay, yeah, so with that, how did you kind of find your place or your journey to television?
I didn't pursue it, per se. I came out of school loving Shakespeare and wanting to make Shakespeare, to create theater and do all of the great Shakespearean roles, ones that I thought were great. And when I was in New York, I had an agent, and there were auditions for film and television, so I went on them, and it was a whole different animal than auditioning for theater, and there were things to learn about how to do that well, but there was no point in not doing them. There was no point in abjuring from trying to do that work. That's where I was a New York actor. So I would be seen for whatever somebody would see me for, whatever my agent was efficient at getting me auditions for, and I'd do my best. And, I was learning. I wasn't a great actor. I was trying to figure out how to do that. And doing auditions isn't even acting. It's a whole different set of skills.
Mm. Yeah.
And learning how to navigate those rooms. And I was, what would I have been? 20 something, with short dreadlocks, really short, spiky hair that was growing. And it didn't look like, I was reading like a leading man, but I didn't look like one. I looked like something, and again, once you start to delve into the sociology of it, that look to America is not leading man. That look is childish or dangerous or thuggish, right? But it's not leading man, And on the other side of that coin, I didn't read like a thug. I mean, all of these works were coming out like Juice and Boys in the Hood, where all of a sudden, this idea of black urban life was coming to the screen and being embraced by the screen. So there were all these roles that I was being asked to read for that were people that I didn't live and didn't know and wasn't close to in my life. Mm-hmm. So I didn't read like that. I looked, as much the part as from a white American perspective, much more that than leading men, but I didn't sound it. I wasn't able to create, I didn't exude that energy. And the place where everything finally came together was on All My Children, because I think, I've told this story again and again, and I get tired of hearing myself tell it, but I think it is so important to this idea of me finding my own way through, as an African-American male, through the maze of this industry, with that as such an overarching determining factor. And this was that in that moment, my hair had reached a length where to white America, it had become sexy, right? It was no longer dangerous, it was exotic.
Yeah.
Right? And because I was exotic, I suddenly became hireable. And I had been working long enough to have the tools. I still wasn't really good at it. Again, daytime TV is a whole nother set of skills, right? To to do, working, doing a script a day and working in close up all the time. So wanting, needing to do less and less to convey, you know, whatever it is you're acting. And I didn't have any of those skills, but I'd gotten good enough to get hired as this attractive thing to look at.
Yeah.
You know, God knows there are some great daytime actors, but it's certainly not a prerequisite. And so there I was, again, navigating who that was and what that was. Originally, the character was written to be dressed with sneakers that were unlaced and big baggy pants and gold chains around his neck. And, you know, I don't need to tell you, that was somebody's idea.
Yes.
Of what this character should be. And I said, well, who is he? And they say, well, you know, he's sort of from the quote unquote other side of the tracks, and he's mostly a criminal. He does his, you know, he makes his money maybe by stealing stuff. And, you know, there was a scene where I was in somebody's house and I stole a silver ashtray. And as an actor, I said, okay, well, I'll play that. But the fact of the matter is, you know, most criminals I know tie their shoelaces so they can run.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have baggy clothes because they get baggy clothes get caught on things,
mm-hmm.
You know, so smart criminals, you know, make other choices. And when they're inside places, they're looking at how the windows and doors are locked and things like that. So these are all things that an actor can play, you know, which are interesting to watch, as opposed to trying to be your stereotype of what the urban black male is. And it worked out really well for them, because the picture that was painted was of this multifaceted, complex character for daytime, who had a lot of different things going on, which are just interesting and compelling to look at.
Yeah.
But had I not had I been only concerned in maintaining, keeping the job,
mm-hmm.
I would not have broached any of these issues. I would not have asked. I would not have pushed that envelope. And I was already at a place in my life and career where I was thinking, gee, I need to start to make some choices about how I am seen and portrayed, mm-hmm. because these digital formats, they exist forever. Somebody will always be able to look you up and look at you being whatever that is. So, yeah. You know, you might want to be some things that don't, that make you feel good about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the character. I enjoyed the character very much. It's just that in daytime, they don't develop. They are a thing and they stay that for 25 years.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's all for entertainment's sake, you know, to keep people watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. It's
right.
Just that as a performer, my need was, because making money was not my first priority, and God knows I needed it just like everybody else, and I loved having it. You know,
yeah.
It was not the thing that determined what I would do. I never envisioned me staying on a show like that for 20 years, like colleagues of mine have done, you know, and had wonderful lives. But it's not my life, you know. And, you know, part of me, perhaps self-righteously, thought, okay, if you are creating images that people are looking at, then you are on some level a role model. You are making choices that you are proud of, that have integrity. And, you know, maybe for black men, but as much for entertainers, as people coming along saying, well, look what this actor did. Or has tried to do in terms of the way he's chosen his roles and what he's stood up for and what he's, you know, and look at the nuance in these roles he's created.
And as a black man, in the heat of all that, do you feel like you had the respect that you were looking for?
No, we never do completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
We never do, Gabe, because that's not what was built here. Now,
mm-hmm.
now, you can argue that a lot of people who interact with you and exhibit a lack of respect don't know that they're exhibiting a lack of respect, right? Because that's how deeply entrenched the system is. That's how white privilege works, right? people who have it don't know that they have it. In fact, they could argue vociferously that they don't have it, right? Because it is deep and systemized and in many ways hidden. And when you draw attention to it, you create conflict. So, you know, there are choices that we have to make as Black people. How do we move forward? Is this a hill I want to die on? You know, is this a fight I want to have, or is there a more important one that's down the road? I need to wait for that. You know, you certainly can't have them all because you'd be having them every day.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, yeah, I mean, there's no point in going back and pointing fingers now, but suffice it to say that, you know, take the first example of getting this script, being hired, getting the script and seeing that this guy is described as, you know, this thug. And you go to costumes and they put on all this stuff on you, which is a stereotype of, you know, what had been perpetuated for forever, at least the last 10 years in terms of the style choices of Black men, which evolved from prison wear. And that being an extension of the criminality that has been attributed to Black men since slavery.
Yes.
Certainly since Reconstruction, right? Mm-hmm. The danger of Blackness, right? And you as a young actor just really wanting to act and seeing these things and wanting to say, this is unacceptable. And these are the reasons mm-hmm. that it is. You need to sit and hear this. Well, you can't do all that, right?
Right.
They don't give you room to do that. And that in itself is a form of disrespect. They may not know that that's what they're offering you, but that's what it is. So instead, you choose, or I chose, to suggest other directions. And sometimes that was accepted and sometimes it wasn't, you know. But I think it certainly in the end created a much more nuanced and complex character than he ever would have been on the page.
Great. Cool. So let's move on to talking more about Shakespeare, because like you said earlier, that's a whole different monster.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm interested to hear how your experiences have been tackling these, you know, big plays, big roles in different regional theaters.
Well, I mean, I got to start by saying there haven't been as many big roles as I would have envisioned or as I aspired to. I mean, I loved Shakespeare from day one, and you know, the competition was stiff. There were better actors sometimes. There were casting choices that, you know, we can't kid ourselves. There were casting choices that had to do with racial bias. You know, mm-hmm. do we want a Black Romeo? Do we want a Black Hamlet? You know, so in the final analysis, there wasn't as much of that. There was no Romeo. There was no Hamlet. And I lament that. I miss those roles. You know, when I was at your school at DeSales, it's funny. I tell people all the time. When I auditioned for that, I had just had a conversation with my agent where I said, "Look, I've been doing this for nigh on 30 years. Right, mm. It's time for me to play Shakespeare's characters whose names are in the title.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and this came along, and I remember saying to the director." You know, it's funny. I God has a sense of humor because I finally get a Shakespeare character whose name is the title, and he's the only one who dies after Act Two.
Like, oh, gotcha.
There's a latent irony to all of this, but you know. I embraced the roles that came to me and tried to do them well. And of course, there's a learning curve. I did not go to graduate school. I came out of undergrad, just wanted to go do the work. I said, this is how I'm going to learn. So, you know, you would go out and you'd do a three-week or four-week or six-week gig. And then there wouldn't be another one for 8 months, right?
Mm.
Because I wasn't the actor who was getting hired all the time. And 8 months later, it's sort of like you're learning to ride that bicycle all over again. And that was difficult, you know. So I was not always pleased with the work that I was doing. I was not, and certainly the structure of American theater production does not lend itself to doing great work because it's all rushed. It's all about money. It's all about making fast choices. Nothing is allowed to ferment and evolve, you know, and then it's over. And
yeah.
You know, that was always difficult for me. Nevertheless, we become better actors just by virtue of the process of aging, right? We have more to draw on as we age. We have a perspective that is more nuanced because just we're simply more mature. You know, so that goes into the work and allows for more layered portrayals of the characters. In every situation, there were situations of bias to navigate. And again, that's just because that's what the country is, right? Nothing, no industry escapes from it when it is the overarching form. You cannot found a country on the labor of owned bodies and all the wealth created from that labor and maintain it in one form or another for hundreds of years and then get to this point and act like it's not there. It is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's in everything. It affects everything. Again, as a performer, you have to be smart enough not to make it the issue. As much as it is the issue, as much as it's present all day, every day, you'll never work if you're always bringing that to people's attention, right? If you're making that, you know, that becomes the stuff of comedy, you know, the guy who's so militant, it's like, why has it got to be black? Why you guys say that? You know, you can't be that guy, right? Because you know, you never finding that the tools to navigate that is also part of the training, right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of learning to work in this industry,
right? And so, did you feel the pressure, especially when you got these roles? Othello, there you go. That's a title character for you. Did you feel the pressure of proving yourself to, I don't know, white America that you were capable of performing? Like, Oberon, who's not supposed to be black, did you have to prove yourself to say that I, too, can tackle this?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I like Oberon, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that the idea of, you know, I don't like the term colorblind casting. I don't think mm-hmm. it really makes any sense. Nobody's colorblind. We see who we're casting
right.
as what, and
yeah.
we have reasons for it. But I think Shakespeare's canon, the mythic quality and scope of it, allows for, by and large, in many respects, anybody to be anything.
Yeah.
Right, in many, many respects. And I'm easier with it there than anywhere else. So I always thought that I could be, you know, any of the roles, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked Oberon and was happy to do that. Oberon and Theseus, which they usually cast together these days.
Right.
And by the time I was being cast as such, I knew that I could deliver. And you know, there's this whole process of learning to love oneself as a performer that happens as you age. Learning to, you've done the work, you've trained, you know you have talent, you know you've spent time doing this work and learning to do it well. And if somebody's not buying you, they're not buying you for their own reasons. And, you know, your sense that you have great value, that your presence is a gift, that you are there as good, if not better, as anyone else. Having that confidence in oneself, that creative arrogance, for lack mm-hmm. of a better term, has to grow as well. And by the time I was getting cast as Oberon's, I had plenty of that. I was like, yeah, this is, I got this, you know, It's not a problem. In fact, you'd be stupid not to cast me.
Yeah. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the episode. And so now I guess we could talk about your most recent work, American Moor, which I read for the first time last month. Mm-hmm. And I wish I knew about it earlier. Yeah, so I guess that, to start off, we can talk about what the early inspiration was for you to write this. Because I get the sense that, you know, reading it, especially since it's a one-person play, that you literally wrote it to give yourself a character and a piece for other people to hear.
That's partly true. I mean, it's actually a two-character play. Right. There is a second character in this play, and he's alive. He's presence. He's a human being out there in the audience.
Yes.
Speaking back. I had come along watching too many people do solo shows when there was nothing else for them to do. They weren't getting work, so they created work. And while I admire and encourage the creating of one's own work, I mean, I am a huge advocate of that. I didn't feel like any of the one-man shows that I saw were things that I could do. There were a couple of varieties. Mm-hmm. There were things that were kind of like the celebrities would do to poke fun at themselves. Like Carrie Fisher did a thing called, I think it was called Critical Drinking, which was a show about her life, you know, her life that was kind of a mess. And she said, I'll do this show about me and you'll come and you'll pay money and we'll all laugh. And that's that. Then you have another variety, which is like Lawrence Fishburne doing Thurgood, where he does character work. And he becomes this character for an hour and a half. Or Ali, you know, a couple of different one-man shows based on Muhammad Ali. And I felt like I was not the person to do those either. I wasn't that much of a character actor. Or if I was, it wasn't a character who needed to so closely resemble such an icon, right? If you're doing Ali, everybody knows what Ali sounds like, right? Everybody knows what Ali looks like. Everybody knows how Ali behaved. You know, if you're doing that, then you better be pretty close because they're going to be comparing, right? If you're going to create a character, create one that nobody knows so they cannot say you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So I didn't think I'd be good at that either. But I got into a place in 2012 where, you know, things had not generally been happening the way I'd wanted them to. There were, you know, monetary successes throughout my career, but I didn't feel like there were a great many creative ones. You know, I could talk about creating characters for TV and saying, well, yeah, you got to create them, but they weren't ongoing. They weren't things that grew and changed. They weren't things that you want to stay with for a long time. So you stepped off and went on to something else. So not a lot of creative successes. And I reached a place one day in the wake of an audition, which made me very angry, where I was just fed up and needing to vent that. And I put it all on paper. And a couple of colleagues said, this is important. There's energies in this work that are very important. Let's see if you can expand this, see if you can develop this. And I worked on it for a while longer. It became this play. And the first public performance of this play was responded to in a way that surprised me. People said, this is my story, this is our story, this is everybody's story, this needs to be heard. And I thought I was just telling this story as the experience of at most, you know, African-American men in general, but really just this one African-American male experience. And it was, what was in it, what was being expressed, was really all this stuff that we've been discussing for the last half hour.
Yeah. Right?
All of this meandering through the industry and coming to an understanding of who and where, who you are and where you sat and how people perceived you and why, and striving to navigate that, but to continue to do the work and do it well in the meantime and be respected for what you bring to the table. Be respected for your sense of creative arrogance. And of course, any kind of arrogance from black people is difficult for white America to deal with. You know, anything that smacks of arrogance, again, brings in the issues of danger, black danger. And, you know, there's a one-to-one correlation with the play, because, you know, the play is talking about, you know, the dangerousness of Othello tendency to exhibit power and danger versus his tendency to put people off guard and charm them. And that particular black man saying he's not interested in charming them. He's interested in being authentic, and no matter what it does, because he's too valuable to himself and to them, you know, and he knows it, to play stupid games. And the grand irony is that when you step outside the play, in producing the play and trying to find productions and stages for the play over 7 years, again and again, having to live and navigate that same dynamic, because here's this large African-American male talking to basically the people who have the money, which is by and large white people, who are making choices based on their deeply entrenched biases, right? And saying, you know, could you be nicer? Could you be nicer in that section of the play? Because, you know, if you, you know, just be, you know, could you just do it, just tone that down a little bit? Because if you don't, we're not going to sell as many tickets if you're, you know. It's deep, man. It's really deep. But that's where it started. I was at a boiling point with so much of what I had been in where my career had been, where it had gotten to, and who I was in it and why, you know, trying to navigate that. And it became this play.
Was this your first time like writing a full play yourself?
No, I had written other plays. None that I think have this value.
Sure.
I've written for both stage and screen, and I guess I still do. This one was channeling some ancestors, you know, genuinely, and it shows. And I tell people all the time, you know, I'm not quite ready to take credit for all of it, because I don't, you know, comparatively, you know, from my own perspective, comparatively, this is really far and away much better than most of the stuff I write. So no, it wasn't the first work, but it was certainly the first one of this caliber.
Right. Do you want to talk about the early works of, you know, getting it up on its feet and doing the first production? Because I know it took you a while to get to Broadway. And I don't know if that was your goal, or what was that process like for you?
Well, we never got to Broadway. We got off Broadway.
Yeah.
And it was certainly, we were certainly shooting for a Broadway house. And I say that because I think that, and certainly the current historical moment and all the things that are trying to happen in the American theater in the wake of it, you know, the theater is being called upon to restructure, right? Organizations like We See You, White American Theater, hands the industry this list of demands, saying, you're dark, so you have been checked in your ability to continue on as you are, this money-making entity that uses and promotes all of the tools of American racism to perpetuate itself, right? You have been stopped because of a pandemic. Now what are you going to do? When you are allowed to start again, is it going to be something that includes us? Because now you have the time to do that, and these are the ways to do it. And I think it's a powerful moment and a powerful statement. And American Moore is very much, sort of crystallizes that argument. And I knew that before the pandemic. I knew that before George Floyd. I knew that, you know, years and years ago, as, you know, as did most African American performers and other performers of color. So I thought early on, once I realized that this play was what it was, I thought this needs to be a national discussion. This needs Broadway, because that's where you garner the national discussion. And we were eager to get it there, and my job was to run behind it and make it as good as possible. You know, I and my director and our designers, you know, that was all a collaborative effort. And the show that we brought to the Cherry Lane was a really powerful show at a time where not a lot of people come to theater, right? It was we had a window that was 2 weeks prior to Labor Day, where most of New York is gone. And then the 2 weeks after Labor Day, they're busy getting their kids in school. And then 2 weeks after that, we closed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you go out into the blogosphere and look up Google and look up the reviews, you will see about 22 stellar reviews for that show and one tepid review by the New York Times. Right? And this is an age old case. It happens again and again. You know, the Times, for all it is and is not, and for all of the various ways that we are now getting our information and journalists we are trusting, they still have this inordinate power to say this is so or this is not so. Right. Mm. And so those things combined created a lull, a stopping point. You know, we could not go on from there. And then coronavirus happened. Right. So my attention turned to getting the publishing done so that people could see it. Now it's being used in schools and taught in high school and college classes. So that's a whole nother track that the piece is on. But my intent is still to get it back to the center of this discussion that is raging around what is the theater as it is impacted by these current events and these current discussions about American bias and race relations. What is the theater going to do? And where does this play fit into all that? It fits right smack in the middle of it. But yeah, it's still a process of getting people to see and understand that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered that question or not. What did we do?
Yeah, you definitely did. You definitely did. I was going to talk about the relevancy of the play, but we can kind of get into some of what it's about here. So do you want to discuss, I guess, the general themes of the play and what it gets at with this character that I just love?
Sure. I kid people that the elevator pitch is the experience of American black men using Shakespeare's Othello as metaphor, and people's eyes glaze over. You realize it's not a very good elevator pitch. So I say, you know, just take that. That's the overarching theme, and what that breaks down to is an African American, large African American male who is of the age to be an Othello. Yeah. And who loves Shakespeare and does it well, is auditioning for this play. God knows how many times he's auditioned for it before. God knows how many rooms he's navigated the racial issues throughout his aspirations as a classical actor. Finds himself auditioning for this play before a much younger white director. Who has gone to school, who has studied and knows what he thinks he knows, and is in a position of power in this particular situation, a position of giving him or not giving him the job, mm-hmm. and has preconceived ideas of who that character should be in his production. And those ideas don't jibe with those of the African-American actor. And shenanigans ensue, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. There is an immediate question of, is it the actor's job to give the director simply what he wants, or is it a collaboration? If it's a collaboration, does it work the same with a young white director and an older black actor as it would with a younger white director and an older white actor, you know, or if they were the same age? What is the difference? Is this person in his youth, because he has achieved this role as director, does he still have this latent sense of privilege that he's not aware of, that he has the right to? We talked about, you know, latent forms of disrespect before, right? Mm-hmm. Does he know when he's being disrespectful? Can he be told, and can he learn from it, and the work go on, or is it an impediment to creativity in this work? And the actor is having to navigate these questions and many others about his presence, existential questions, really, while in the midst of this 5-minute audition. So there is a 90-minute inner monologue that goes on that the audience is privy to. And in it, you know, are all these arguments and the stuff of the play that speak to whose perspectives matter, whose understanding of being Black is more authentic. Is it mine because I am, or is it yours because of what you see or you think you see? Can we make better theater? Can we make theater that could we do a better job if we had 6, 7, 8 weeks to rehearse this play as opposed to 3 or 4? What are the relationships within the context of Othello, and why do they exist and how? We don't get deeply into, we hint at, but don't get deeply into the story of Othello itself, you know, and how that should be perceived and developed. We stick pretty closely to just the Othello character himself and use him as metaphor for African-American men at large.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's sort of what the theater's about.
And is there a particular moment in the play, this might be a weird question because you wrote it, but is there a moment that's difficult for you to put forth for a white audience?
Is there a moment where what's difficult for me to put forth?
Any line or any moment in the play that you're like, or maybe you were hesitant about keeping?
Oh, well, there were a great many. I mean, over 7 years, there was a lot of editing and a lot of evolution. And there were, you know, when you talk about the African-American experience, you can riff in any number of directions for ages. And,
right.
You know, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, it's vastly complex, but it doesn't make good drama, right? So you're going to start with a play that has way too much and goes in way too many directions and start to lop off, you know, pieces. Not that they weren't important and things to explore, but they don't make the most salient and most effective play. Anything that was kept, I think, in this version that you read, which represents the definitive version, was important and needed to remain there. All of it. I mean, there are issues of aging, right? And we talked about, you know, not having the opportunity to play these great roles, and the clock is ticking, you know. And this character feels his clock ticking, you know. And it influences what he does in that room. Should I make choices that allow me to play this role, i.e. appease this director, so that I can play this role before it gets too late, before I'm no longer strong enough to be this guy as I need to be him and I want to be him. Do I even like him? Do I even care? Why am I here? Why am I doing this? So there's those existential issues that come up again. There are issues about state-sanctioned violence against Black men are difficult to navigate when they come up, and sometimes they take me wholly by surprise because the connection is so great. Those young men, those boys, perceived as a threat by somebody, irrespective of anything they did or didn't do, right? And losing their lives because of that. Me standing on this stage, perceived as a threat because I am just being wholly authentic, right? Mm-hmm. And you making choices. You don't have a gun in your hand, but you are making choices, right? About how I metaphorically will or will not survive.
Yeah.
Right? In this situation. So, yeah, I mean, it's not an easy 90 minutes to get through.
Yeah.
There's nothing particular that's left that's harder than anything else. I think the hardest thing really is not being when the character is played as I play him, his anger is very present and authentic, and I refuse to mitigate it. And, you know, this, as I said, confuses and worries producers. They say, well, can you be less than? I say, well, then it wouldn't be the play. You know, can you be, you know, white America wants to take the focus off them, right? We don't want to argue, if I'm here doing your play, I'm the good guy, right? If I'm producing your play, I'm the good guy. I don't want to be the focus of, I don't want to be indicted, you know. And of course, the answer to that is, you know, nothing changes until you start to own up to your part of this, you know. And so that's a point of navigation, being this guy authentically who frightens Americans. And when I say Americans, you know what I'm talking about. That said, those who have come and opened their minds and hearts to this have been moved in extraordinary and surprising ways and have come back again and again to reconsider this work and stayed for post-performance discussions where we've engaged in dialogue about it. So I am not scared that it is too much for a white audience. In fact, it is the perfect time when everybody has sort of been made, at least in theory, more available to the discussion.
Yeah, we hit on collaboration briefly earlier, and I'm interested to hear from you how the dynamics of collaboration works when you have a white director and a, you know, a black actor. And of course, you hit on this in the play, but if you could just speak to white American directors, what is your, you know, ultimate advice for them?
Well, I mean, it's like the advice you give to any other white American, which is listen, be available, do the difficult introspective work of looking, examining, and understanding how you yourself are complicit, how you are yourself are part of the problem, and not the solution, how you yourself perceive and act in your manifesting every day of your life because you live here, right?
Yeah.
And do that before you take on the responsibility of being the person in control. I don't think anybody, you know, would deny a director their control, right? Nobody, that's theater. The director is the director. I will not deny you your control, but I have to trust you, you know.
Yeah.
And there are examples of that. You know, that there's an example that I like to use about Brando, who you know, it's in a couple of his biographies. They'd say, you know, he'd go meet a new director on the first day of a film, and just totally phone in the first take, right? Just throw it out there, right? Like just whatever. And if the director liked it and said moving on, he'd phone in the rest of the performance because he's like, if the director doesn't know good from bad, why should I? I don't trust him. So I'm just not going to bother, right? Similarly, within Othello itself, you know, there is a point where Desdemona says to Othello, whate'er you be, I am obedient. And that's a troubling line to a lot of people because it speaks about power exchange. It speaks to, you know, what does that mean? You know, the good, obedient wife. But she's so strong everywhere else in the play that I think it means I will relinquish control because you're the man and you seem to want it. But that doesn't mean you get to be an asshole.
Yes.
I'm watching you, right?
Yeah.
And the moment I don't trust you, that's going away, you know? And, you know, I think this dynamic is very similar between actor and director, you know, everywhere, but certainly heightened by the color line.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically enough, you know, I have had for 5 of the 7 years of this play's development a white female director. And she, you know, what we had working for us is that we were old friends, so we've known each other as people for many, many, many years and want the best for one another and are able to talk on a level that, you know, newly acquainted people might not. Doesn't mean that there wasn't work to do for both of us to reach across that line and make sure we were understanding each other, check ourselves, you know, and think, well, what am I perceiving here? What am I doing and perceiving here that might not be, you know, might be created by my particular bias. And she has lent a great deal as she has grown in the work and learned from the doing after the doing after the doing of productions, what this is. We have evolved it together. So that collaboration has been very important. So it can be done.
Yeah.
You know, it can be done, but you know, so can universal peace and brotherhood. It's just, it's going to take a hell of a lot of work. Is anybody ready to do that work?
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, this play would have been relevant if it was written in the 90s. It certainly, I don't know if it's more relevant now, but it certainly hits home today. You know, as I read it last month, I was just like, man,
this is it, you know? Right? That's what I'm saying. This is it. Right.
And
getting people who are, you know, the power brokers of American theater to understand and see that has been the difficult part. Because it is show business, and they're, you know, the economic drivers that influence what is done in a country built on unregulated capitalism doesn't always have room for what is most relevant, most important, most healing, most world culture changing. It really doesn't, you know, it's not about that. It's about, am I going to make money? So it has been difficult to get it into the hands and to the attention of people who have its best interest at heart, which is, you know, and the culture's best interest. It speaks to everything we're dealing with in this moment.
Yeah.
And so the work continues.
Yeah. And I look forward to hopefully seeing it live.
Well, I
soon.
Hope you get to see it live too. Gabe. Yeah. We are working on that. And you know, all I can do is continue to work on it because it's that important a piece. And I don't say that about anything else in my body of work. I mean, this is just wholly relevant theater. And I think the ancestors, you know, sort of put this on the page through me for really, really important reasons right now.
Yeah.
You know, not some other time, but now. So we will see.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Keith. This has been a great conversation, great interview.
Hey, brother, of course. It has been fun for me, and I love being inquired after and asked for, and I'm just grateful. Thank you.
Thank you to Keith Hamilton Cobb and Rosalind Coleman Williams for two great interviews. Well, that's a wrap. It has been a pleasure and an honor getting to educate and entertain you with the careers and lives of some of the most amazing Black artists in the game. This is just the beginning. I'm not going anywhere. Over the next few weeks, I'll be releasing bonus episodes to provide more content before Season 2. Season 2 will begin at the end of December, just in time for the holidays. Again, I would like to thank you all for listening and going on this journey with me. It has been the highlight of my year. I pray you learn something new and are able to stay educated, inspired, and entertained by Black lives who deserve the utmost respect and praise. It's an honor to honor them on this platform. Well, I'll talk to you soon. Until next time, I'm Gabe Moses, and Black Artists Matter. Godspeed.